Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, we have 5 days left to turn in our mail-in ballot or vote the old-fashioned way. Despite ballots being sent out a month in advance and offering conditional same-day registration on Election Day, there are a wide range of factors why someone shows up to take part in the electoral process while others just sit it out. Our first guest will argue the simplified explanation of apathy isn't only inaccurate, but is ultimately harmful to voter engagement. Mindy Romero is a professor and director of the USC Center for Inclusive Democracy, a nonpartisan research center focused on elections, voting behaviors, and political participation. Mindy's one of our go-tos to understand the barriers and the factors that lead to voter turnout that is really far from reflective of California's diversity, with the goal of creating opportunities to close that historical gap so that elections are representative of all of those who are impacted by policy. Mindy, nice to see you.
Thanks for having me again, and in person.
Yes, in person. It's nice to see your face. Shaping up to be a normal midterm for you, or is there kind of like a big headline as we head into November 8th?
Well, these days, what is normal, right?
Exactly.
Especially in elections. I think in terms of turnout, we're thinking that it's going to be a good year again for turnout. Might not match or meet 2018's numbers, but you know, we've been generally on an upswing on turnout. The thing is we don't have a competitive gubernatorial race, by all accounts. And that's a big driver in a midterm year in California. We have fewer propositions on the ballot, and most of them seem to be not competitive. Prop 1, of course, being the noteworthy exclusion there in terms of amount of support, at least.
That's about abortion.
Yes, thank you. Abortion rights, the constitutional amendment. As it comes down, the midterms for most people are about the battle for control over Congress. And we often don't think of California as kind of being consequential because we think of, the presidential race and we're blue state. But when it comes to the battle for control of Congress, we've got about 10 somewhat at least competitive districts. So the battle comes right through our state. We've got at least six that are very competitive, right through the Central Valley and parts of Southern California. And so we will play a role on the national level. We play all local races, make a difference, matter. But I think there is a concern that at a state and local level, there's not a lot of drivers other than congressional districts that are getting kind of that attention and resources and time. And
you had said what is and isn't happening motivates voters to show up or to not show up, so that can be very different depending if you're in the Central Valley in a very competitive congressional race or if you're not, and if you are more likely to get calls and political ads, campaign ads, or if you're not really hearing from everyone.
Well, and let's be honest too, so there's a huge segment of the potential voting electorate that gets nothing. And we have a lot of survey data over the years to say even registered voters, but if they come from historically underrepresented groups, they don't kind of meet the likely voter model for campaigns. Mm-hmm. Even in registered, they'll be less likely to get all of those flyers that many of your listeners are probably sick of getting, and calls and ads. So there is certainly an information gap in elections, period. And it varies by race, ethnicity, income, age. And then you, on top of that, put a whole bunch of essentially non-competitive. Now, every vote matters. Every race is important. Everyone should pay attention to every race, of course, and be informed on their vote. But the reality is when a race is considered to be not competitive, people will vote the party line or sometimes feel like they don't have to vote. Well, they always vote the party line, almost always these days. But they'll feel like it's not as relevant for them, and that can affect turnout and overall engagement in the election, and quite frankly, it can affect the long term of how people feel in terms of just whether they think elections are salient. We already have a crisis in many ways of so many people, even regular voters, feeling disconnected from the political process.
Yeah, and even aside from candidates, I mean, when talking about propositions or local measures that people will be voting on, it may be the first time that they're learning about it when they open up, their textbook of a ballot, and then they start informing themselves. That can be such an overwhelming process when you have so many other things going on in your life. And it's kind of, but it is also, on the other hand, surprising given that we get these things like a month in advance, the voter information guide, especially for statewide propositions. What do you think are the biggest barriers that gets people from, actually opening it up, giving themselves enough time to inform themselves, to actually doing it, you know, maybe the day of or the night of, and then just kind of being overwhelmed by the process.
Yeah, a lot of voters are overwhelmed, especially if you're not a regular voter. If you're a new voter, if you're a young person, first or second time you're voting, there's just kind of the nuts and bolts that people still, a lot of people don't feel completely comfortable with. And even though they get that voter guide, you know, they still need support. They need to know where to independently get information on candidates so they feel comfortable and informed. They need kind of, especially young people, need kind of greater support in terms of kind of walking them through the electoral process. That's the reason why some voters, young people, don't participate, because they don't, you know, trust that or feel comfortable. So it's, and the reality of people's lives these days, especially if you have kids and families or you're working several jobs or whatever it might be. And if you think that already you're on the fence about whether an election matters, you know, are you going to put that work in? So maybe it's going to take more work for you to get that information because you're not getting that outreach from campaigns. You have to kind of make sense of all of it. You don't want to make a mistake. You don't want to, you know, do something that might be hurtful for your community. Some voters sit it out because of that. So it's a there's an information gap. There's an outreach gap. There's a lot of good work by, we should note, here in Sacramento as well, by community groups that try to fill those gaps, but they're fighting an uphill battle in terms of resources. So just to remember that, you know, we have some of the lowest turnout rates amongst established democracies in the world. Even when it's a good year for turnout for us, it's bad compared to everybody else. There's real reasons for these disparities, these lower turnout rates and disparities. And understanding kind of how the system disadvantages many voter groups from participating when it might seem like to some people who are diehard voters, like what's so hard? It is hard. And we know that there's a big difference in how people are kind of integrated or not integrated into the electoral system.
Yeah, when talking about, you know, the fact that voters typically vote in line with their party, is there a harm of being unprepared or disengaged with issues and then just kind of voting in line with your party?
Happens all the time. So one of the biggest, probably the key predictor of how somebody's going to vote is their party affiliation. If you're Democrat or Republican, you're going to vote that way. There's just that small little independent or at least kind of swing voter that most campaigns are kind of going for. In terms of the, you know, the strength of our democracy, it's not good if I would contend if voters are not fully informed and really confident and comfortable in their vote. If they're voting the party line and they feel comfortable with that, but I think a lot of voters, you know, they vote the party line, but maybe even inside they're not quite sure if that's the right person. Maybe they think if it's a lesser of two evils, maybe they don't have enough information. They say, well, I know a little bit about this incumbent, right, because of the party or because I've seen them around and I don't know about the challenger. Or I've heard, essentially, right, as I've interpreted it, my vote doesn't matter because it's a done deal anyway and it's not a competitive race. So you have a lot of people who aren't participating, but people who are participating who aren't fully informed or at least fully engaged because of, again, the structure where we produce all of these, you know, non-competitive, essentially, right, winner-take-all races, and we have a dominant two-party system, and people, you know, again, with that outreach gap, all of it kind of comes together to kind of suppress turnout, but also in unequal ways where we see, as you mentioned at the outset, we should mention it again, it's important. We consistently, election after election, high or low turnout, doesn't matter. We have a voting electorate in every election that doesn't look like, doesn't represent the rest of the state. It's older, wealthier, whiter. Young people are underrepresented. People of color are underrepresented. And that has real consequences in terms of policy, outreach, real outcomes in communities. And I'd argue for everyone, because our elected officials need, and our policymakers need to hear from the full slate of those that they serve.
You know, I think about earlier this week, we were talking about, I was talking with two moderators for a debate for Congressional District 3, and just kind of the issue of getting debates to happen this midterm, especially in a state where Democrats outnumber Republicans 2-1. Do you think campaigns want a high turnout?
Campaigns want to win, period. Whatever it takes, let's be honest. There's always some good exceptions where candidates want, you know, to increase turnout in their community or representation. But overall, again, the kind of our electoral system is incentivizes candidates, right, to just get those people who are going to vote for them out to vote. And usually just the number they need, right? So it's like strategic calculation on their resources, what to spend, right, to get the number that they need to actually win. And again, that means that not everybody's getting that outreach in voter education. It's just those groups or those people that are targeted by campaigns. So, like we saw the recent gubernatorial debate.
On a Sunday afternoon on the radio.
Exactly. opposite NFL games. And, you know, I'm sure that was not by accident. You know, both candidates hopefully sincerely came to the table to inform voters. But the negotiations behind the scenes, which I wasn't privy to, certainly, though, there was calculations, right? Only one debate. It's in the best interest of the incumbent, the governor, right, for there not necessarily to be a lot of press because it's, you know, his election to potentially possibly lose, you know, if there's an awful soundbite or something like that. So, yeah, so people don't get debates as much. People don't get public dialogue and conversation or just even to connect with candidates in ways that you would hope we would see in a robust democracy.
Yeah, well, your center has a really cool tool. It's called a voting location and outreach tool. And this is really to, like, target voter outreach efforts. And you could even help organizations find the best voting locations before an election to really reach voters who are underserved or in marginalized neighborhoods. I like honed in on Sacramento County, and you could see areas where there is a higher eligible voter possibility, voter registration, but there isn't a high voter registration turnout. And then you could really, if you were an organization that really wanted to increase voter turnout and voter engagement, mm-hmm. you could hone in on these areas. What went into creating this tool? Because it's not just in California, it goes across 14 states.
Yeah. Covers over half the U.S. population. So it was an effort that we started in California, funded initially by the James Irvine Foundation. As California was in 2018 adopting the Voters' Choice Act, there was a lot of questions about how can we provide a data tool to help inform the transition from polling places to vote centers and equitable, accessible siting of those new locations, because it was a significant reduction, right, in mm-hmm. the number of actual physical sites. And then the tool evolved. So it still provides, through a modeling, suggested accessible, equitable sites for any jurisdiction. You can look, and the model will suggest a rethinking of maybe the distribution of sites, right, that better matches the voter history and demographics of a community and vote-by-mail use rates and all those sorts of things. We've really expanded all of the data that goes into the modeling. It's also available as individual layers that are mapped. So right now you can go to California, to Sacramento. You'll see dozens of voter history and demographic data mapped down to the census tract. So you can look at Sacramento County and you can see population distribution, young, you know, of youth, of Latinos, of those who have limited English proficiency or those with disabilities, whatever population you're interested in. And you can see voter turnout over the last couple of elections. You can see the high and low turnout in a community. And as you mentioned, you can also see the eligible but not registered rates across mm-hmm. communities, and you can use that for targeting. I welcome anyone who just wants to see more. It can be just even if you don't use it for outreach, I think it can be really enlightening to see the disparities. You know, we often see maybe one county turnout rate, but it varies significantly across our county and all counties in our state to understand, again, that story of voice and have the disparities across communities in terms of their say, right, in our political process. But you also can target it for nonpartisan outreach efforts and hopefully increase turnout in any way that makes sense for you as a user.
You know, I think about how in terms of voter engagement, whether people show up, you know, that phrase like representation matters. And you've talked about how women of color are underrepresented in local government and that women of color, particularly Black women, tend to have less access to financial support. You know, what are the consequences of that long term?
Huge. So, you know, your first off is just the immediate representation of women of color on things like, you know, boards of supervisors or city councils or school boards. But in the long term, it can also, or maybe even not so long term, it can affect potentially turnout rates. So people, again, looking for people that represent them, have similar life experiences. You know, if I see somebody that looks like me and I think has similar values and maybe kind of understands the world and I, you know, think I can trust them a little bit more, I might be more likely to vote. And also there's the pipeline. So here at a local level, people who start off at a city council or maybe a school board or another commission or something of that, but if it's elected, that pipeline really matters, right, for representation at the assembly, at the Senate, at the state level, at the national level, potentially. And women of color have fewer resources, fewer networks that give them financial support, but also just generally support, right, other types of resources and encouragement. And then we have larger societal expectations that are placed on women of color and women, period, when it comes to whether they should be out participating in the election world versus, you know, taking care of home or their community, right? So there's lots of barriers, and it we see it in reality when we see underrepresentation. And we need to support women as much as possible, women of color as much as possible, because of that pipeline impact, at least in that sense.
Yeah, I've heard just with local races in the city of Sacramento that, you know, just the challenge of balancing childcare with running a campaign to run as an elected official, and that may kind of resort in some instances of, as you say, like self-selecting out of the process because it's just too difficult and you don't have those resources and support.
Yeah, and that's an important point. So often women will self-select out. So people will maybe look from the outside and say, oh, well, things have changed, right? A woman can win an election just as a man can win an election. But a lot of women will select out because they know they can't, or they worry they can't win because they don't have the resources, the money, the connections, or also because of those other societal kind of pushes and pulls. And so we don't really have a full or fair kind of slate to be looking at to understand kind of all those barriers to women. Just if you just look at the women that are in play, that are part of the electoral process, that are running, that doesn't give you the full story of the barriers that are at play for women just considering possibly running.
Yeah. I want to end on a very important voting group that doesn't show up as much, and that's the youth vote, younger people. You obviously are located, you talk to a lot of college students. Your center is connected to USC. You've also held a TEDx talk on the power of the youth vote. And you tweeted just like recently that apathy is a blame narrative. Unpack that. What does that mean when it comes to the youth vote?
Thank you. So, you know, when we talk about the youth vote, usually there's acknowledgement, right, that younger people, of course, vote in much lower numbers. They do vote, but they vote in much lower numbers or rates than older voters. And the first thing, almost always, the first explanation for that is, like, people will say, you know, oh, young people don't care. They're apathetic. What's wrong with this generation? And sometimes that transfers even to, well, you know, if they don't care, that's a good thing they're not voting then. I don't want them to make decisions for me or my pocketbook or whatever it might be. But really, that kind of what I call a blame narrative, all it really does is serve to justify not supporting young people, right, in ways that they need to be supported to increase their turnout. So I mentioned outreach earlier. Well, young people consistently, again, even registered to vote, right, young people who are registered, will report not getting campaign materials, calls, again, all those things that we often find annoying. It's really important for especially a first-time voter, right, to bring them into the electoral process, to ask them to vote. Campaigns and candidates often don't talk about issues that are specific to young people, or at least talk in ways that, you know, that connect to young people. And so a young person doesn't feel part of the political process, doesn't hear issues they care about. And then as they've grown up, we have a pretty abysmal civics education in the U.S., lots of wonderful exceptions, but overall, they're not taught the how, you know, what and why voting's important, why of voting. And so we don't support them in that. They turn 18 and we expect them to magically both know how to vote and want to vote and feel like it's important. And then we put them out there and then they don't hear issues. Campaigns aren't courting them or talking to them. And then they don't participate in high numbers. And then what do? We blame them for it. So it's really important that we support our young people, hopefully systemically, so they turn 18 and they have that support they need. But really, if we want to end on a positive note, everyone listening today, right, can play a role. We know peer-to-peer contact is the most powerful. So if you're a young person, reach out to your other young people. Don't blame your friends and fellow students for not participating.
Or judge them.
Don't judge them because, you know,
they can be counterproductive.
Yeah, that's counterproductive. And again, that's kind of the blame suppression kind of narrative, right? So anyway, we can all reach out, encourage young people, ask them for the support they need. What is that support? And most importantly, make the case for voting, at least increase their chances of voting. Maybe even bring a young person with us, you know, to vote or help them vote by mail. So it's a societal issue and it's a societal responsibility. And the numbers don't lie in terms of the level of support that young people. And what I do know is, and I'm sure many people that are listening today know, that young people are really engaged in a lot of civic and political issues. They just don't see why voting is an actionable step on something they care about. They need support in making the case for voting. Mm-hmm.
Mindy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's always a fun and interesting conversation. Mindy is a professor and director of the USC Center for Inclusive Democracy, discussing voting behaviors in the days leading up to the midterm. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. As we head into a midterm election, there is concern over the potential for political violence if election results are not accepted by Trump-endorsed politicians. In the aftermath of the attack on Paul Pelosi, the husband of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the threat for political violence is more real. A recent survey focuses on the identification of groups that may be at high risk for political violence, such as MAGA Republicans, that's short for Make America Great Again. Joining us now is Dr. Garen Wintemute, an emergency medicine physician and firearm violence researcher based at UC Davis Health, who conducted new research about the willingness to support or engage in political violence. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Wintemute.
Vicky, good morning. Thanks for having me.
You know, I'm sure taking us right back to the beginning, was there a cascade of events that you were noticing or a specific moment that sparked this research and this survey?
There was a cascade. We, as you mentioned, do firearm violence research and had done some special research on trends during the pandemic and noted both increases in crime rates and an absolutely unprecedented surge in firearm purchasing. And as we followed that forward and started looking at why it might be happening, we discovered high levels of support for extreme positions, to the limited extent that questions had been asked for political violence, and saw the potential, if these trends converged, for real threat in the future, made contact with some experts in the field who said, oh, yeah, we have trouble ahead, and decided to do a survey about it.
What was the methodology behind this research?
This is a nationwide survey, population representative, involving a professional survey research firm and a panel of people who volunteer to participate in survey research. So the findings apply right across the country. We had more than 8,500 respondents to the survey.
Yeah, and you have, as you just mentioned, you have long studied violence prevention and extended that in recent years to firearm violence. But even these findings surprised you, right?
Yes. Based on the preliminary work that we had done, I was expecting some pretty grim output, but this exceeded my worst expectations. Frankly, in particular, on the questions that had not been asked before. We repeated some questions that had been asked just to sort of benchmark our findings. But if I can give an example, one chill comes from recognizing that 20% of American adults, 30% of MAGA Republicans, as we defined them, strongly or very strongly agree with the statement that a strong leader is more important for America than having a democracy.
You know, when I was reading the study, you know, a strong leader preferred over a democracy, what went into crafting the language for that question?
So I drafted that language, actually sitting right where I'm sitting right now. And remember, a real sense of foreboding. People in prior surveys had measured attitudes and so forth, but no one had presented that direct opportunity to make a choice. And so didn't have a precedent to for guidance, decided to offer that choice and see what happened.
In conducting the research, how did you distinguish a Republican from a MAGA Republican?
This, in a sense, fell into our laps. We let current events help shape the definition. In late August and early September, President Biden gave speeches in which he talked about MAGA Republicans, and in the course of the speech sort of defined them. Republicans, of course, who voted for Donald Trump, and then the additional element, who denied the results of the 2020 election. And in our survey, the way we used that operationally was, to be considered a MAGA Republican, a person had to be a Republican by self-report, a Trump voter, again by self-report, and had to agree strongly or very strongly with the statement that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump and Joe Biden is an illegitimate president.
You also surveyed, I believe, non-MAGA Republicans and also just non-Republicans. What stood out to you about those findings when compared to the findings and results that you got from Make America Great Again Republicans?
Right. We did a general population survey, and then we were able to separate people into groups. What President Biden also did was suggest that MAGA Republicans were more likely than others, other Republicans, to endorse violence. But our first question was, are they really different from other Republicans? And the answer, quite honestly, was very emphatically yes. Compared to other Republicans, MAGA Republicans were substantially more likely to endorse racist positions, such as the idea that discrimination against whites is as big a problem as discrimination against people of color. They were substantially more likely to endorse delusional positions. A quarter of them endorse the core tenet of the QAnon delusion complex, which is to remind listeners, awkward though it is to hear, that America's government and social institutions are controlled by satanic pedophiles who traffic children for sex. They were also substantially more likely than others to endorse the great replacement delusion that white native-born Americans are being replaced by immigrants and people of color.
One of the findings that I found just the most damning, and it was actually like the lead sentence in a LA Times article from I think this morning or earlier this week, it was roughly 5 million Americans from, and this is from your study, would be willing to kill someone to achieve a political purpose. How did you arrive at that number?
Yep. So we first asked everybody, do you support the use of violence to advance political objectives? And then I'm going to oversimplify just to make progress here. And then only if people endorsed the use of violence in the abstract for political purposes, we said, okay, how about you personally? How willing would you personally be, for example, to threaten someone, to injure someone, to kill someone? We asked those questions. We also asked people, how likely is it that you will show up in a situation where you think political violence is justified, show up with a gun, carry a gun out where people can see it, shoot somebody? And people answered those questions. And what we learned, you can take this as good news or bad news, that only a small percentage, about 2% or less, of our respondents said that they would be willing to kill somebody, that they would be willing to shoot somebody, but our 8,600 respondents represent 258 million adults in the United States. So it's roughly 2.5 million people per percentage point, which is how we get to a very rough estimate of 5 million people.
Yeah, and then you couple that with one of your survey questions about whether there would be a civil war in the near future, and the majority surveyed believe that there would be a civil war. I mean, that is a belief in and of itself, and that is one thing. But are you concerned about what this belief could translate into?
Yes. So first, just to insert a qualification, you're right that 51% of the population in general, at some level, agreed with the statement that there will be a civil war in the next few years. It fell to 20% for the people who strongly or very strongly agreed, which is where we've sort of focused our attention, and 30% for MAGA Republicans. Now, in using the term civil war, nobody is expecting trenches and artillery and groups of soldiers with different colored uniforms lining up and shooting at each other. It's a sort of sustained insurgency. And to be honest, what we're finding here reinforces work that has been done at a smaller scale by experts who've been working in this field for years, who emphasize there are organizations in this country right now preparing for war. They want to see it happen. It reinforces their view of where the United States should go. So the potential for large-scale conflict that kills and injures lots of people and puts all of society on even more on edge than it is already is really quite high.
Hmm. Were you surprised? You briefly touched upon this question, but I want to read it again because, I mean, it's so blatant, this survey question, that the government, media, and financial worlds in the U.S. are controlled by a group of Satan-worshipping pedophiles who run a global child sex trafficking operation. One, what led to the language in this question? And also, were you surprised by the number of respondents who actually believe this?
Got it. So first, for listeners, that was the exact language to which our respondents, subjects were presented. We deliberately took that language verbatim from a poll that has been out in the field off repeatedly since 2021, if not earlier, and actually just issued new results within the last two or three days because we wanted to track. And also because we wanted to use existing questions as sort of a foundation for establishing validity where we were asking questions that had not been asked before. So sadly, no, I was not surprised by the responses because we got essentially the same responses that had been given to that question before. And I have to say, our survey was conducted in May and June. The one that was released just yesterday or the day before shows support for that delusion increasing in the United States.
What does that signal to you?
It signals many things. It signals that we are, as a species, as a population, as a society, capable, many of us are capable of entertaining beliefs that are widely at variance with reality, which raises concern for me about our judgment, not any group's judgment, but our judgment as a species, frankly. But the other is this, the QAnon delusion, belief in that delusion, has repeatedly been associated with acts of violence, with mass shootings and others. So the fact that lots of people believe this raises concern because some of those people are probably going to be willing to act on the belief, and we're back to a high level of risk of violence.
You know, I was also confused about one finding. I think it was at the bottom where it says they are not more willing to engage personally in political violence. That seems counter to the other findings. Can you help me understand distinguishing between the two of supporting and personally engaging?
Yes, I don't see it as counter, and I take that as one of the real pieces of good news in all of the studies that we've done from this survey. Let me go one step back. It turned out that most people reject political violence, reject violence as a means of solving problems, two-thirds or so across the board. We asked, in general, do you think it's a good idea? And regardless of what you think in general, how about each of these specific instances? Would you do it this time? Do you think it's appropriate this time? And about two-thirds of the population said no over and over and over again. And we should take heart in that. And the second piece of good news is what you asked about. Of the people who said yes, that violence was justifiable in the abstract, the vast majority said, but I wouldn't want to be involved in it myself. That's great news, because the alternative, that lots of people would say, yeah, let's throw down and get at it, that would be really frightening. It's also the kind of news that points us toward an intervention. Other researchers have identified the steps along which people move from entertaining thoughts of violence to actually committing it. And it appears there are lots of people who are somewhere on that pathway, and there are strategies out there to change their trajectories so that they don't further mobilize toward actually committing violence. Mm.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with firearm violence researcher Dr. Garen Wintemute about his latest research about the willingness to support or engage in political violence. We're really focusing on a specific subset of Republicans, MAGA Republicans. But I'm curious, what role do you think, if any, should traditional talking points play in what we are seeing collectively in our country? Because on the one hand, we have people who vocally support and believe things like, you know, the big lie. But do you think that there is a role that elected officials and people in positions of power play in being silent or complicit, essentially allowing disinformation to play out without challenging it?
Yes, rhetoric and silence both play huge roles here, for ill or for good. On the one hand, it's been established experimentally that, not just at the level of common sense, that violent rhetoric induces violence, can help create a climate of acceptance for violence that makes it easier for people to commit it. Support for violence, even among people who have no intent of engaging in it themselves, the group that you and I just talked about, nonetheless helps create that climate of acceptance, makes violence maybe easier for people who don't have those scruples about personal involvement. Silence is not the absence of taking a position. Silence is at best acquiescence and at worst complicity. And so to switch the point of view, rhetoric can be a huge force for change for the better. There's experimental evidence, there's real world evidence that when leaders say, no, violence is not acceptable, it's not the way we solve problems in this society, it's not the way we solve the particular problem we're discussing, or problems in general, people pay attention to what their leaders say. When peers say, so let's imagine a social media situation and somebody is tweeting trash. If others say, no, this is not how we proceed in the United States, that has influence on the people who are drifting or moving toward violence. So one of the interventions that's needed is for everyone, from ordinary people like you and me and your listeners, to our elected leaders, to our unelected leaders, the people who help shape the way America thinks, to turn our backs on violence and say, no, not now and not ever. The other thing that we need to do that's similar is, and this applies mostly to regular folks like all of us, is if you see something, say something. If somebody is making a credible threat, whether it's to commit personal violence or to commit suicide, you and I have talked about this angle before, Vicky.
Yeah.
We need not to take that in silence. We need to bring that threat to somebody who can do something about it and avert tragedy.
Given everything we've talked about and all the research that you do, were you surprised by the attack on House Speaker Pelosi's husband?
No, not at all. I was saddened first. We need to remember in all of the flurry around the event that a man was seriously injured that day and that evening. And we hope he does make the projected full recovery. It was shocking. Kudos to him. As it turned out, police officers were within a few feet because of that savvy phone call that he made and able to prevent him from being beaten to death. But no, I wasn't surprised that it happened to that man on that night. Those are the accidents of circumstance. But that it happened to somebody like him at some point, no, pretty much inevitable. And that the expectation is that there will be further such events, which is why I'm spending so much of your airtime trying to convince people that they have a role in crafting the solution.
In the last 30 seconds to a minute that we have left, probably about 30 seconds, that the midterm is in just a few days, what do you want people to take away from your research and this conversation?
That violence is not acceptable, that all of us have a role to play in ending it. I hope they vote. And I hope they understand that next week is a time of very high risk, and 2024 will be another.
Dr. Wintemute, as always, thank you for the time.
A real pleasure. Thanks, Matt.
Dr. Garen Wintemute is an emergency medicine physician and firearm violence researcher based at UC Davis Health, who conducted new research about the willingness to support or engage in political violence. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, as the weather cools down, a beloved insect makes a return to the California coast. The famed monarch butterflies are making their epic migration from the Rockies to California. But in recent years, scientists have seen significant declines to slight increases, leading scientists to question why their numbers are fluctuating. One key to unlocking this riddle are butterfly counters, who help provide a tally of monarch butterflies fluttering along our coast. Earlier this year, CAP Radio's environment reporter Manola Sakaida took a trip to Pacific Grove to better understand how both monarchs and their dedicated counters descend upon the coast this time of year to measure the health of these incredible creatures. And we thought what a perfect time to revisit this piece and take a trip to Monterey County. Manola, you're new to the area. You came here from Seattle. What was it like to travel to the coast to Pacific Grove and report on this story?
Right. So for some context, Pacific Grove is this small town by Monterey that's been this big destination place for people who want to see monarch butterflies in the winter for a really long time. And typically what happens is that thousands of monarchs will settle in Pacific Grove anywhere between October to, you know, as late as mid-February to wait out the colder months before continuing their migration. And that part of the migration is called overwintering. So yeah, it was my first time in the area, and it was also my first time getting to see monarch butterflies up close. And it was just, you know, really amazing to see these huge clusters of butterflies up close, just in numbers I've never seen before. So it was a really amazing experience, and one that I hope we can still have more opportunities for in the future.
You spoke with three butterfly counters one morning. What does a butterfly counter do? And it's really important, right, that they do their work as the sun is rising?
Yeah, exactly. Basically, a butterfly counter is a person that's been trained to tally monarch butterflies in a specific area and keep track of them. And it's part of this larger statewide effort to understand where monarchs are coming together, you know, how many of them are there in certain places each year. And all of this is with the intention of helping conserve their numbers in the future. So yeah, I got to spend some time with butterfly counters in Pacific Grove for this year's count. And it was a big deal, since last year there were no butterflies in Pacific Grove to count at all. And right, it has to start at sunrise because it's really fast work. Butterflies can't fly when it's cold outside, but once the temperature passes 55 degrees, they start to fly off in these big bursts. So basically the counters have to finish counting the butterflies before it gets too warm. And then, you know, they're all over the place. It's impossible to count them. So yeah, they start at sunrise and it takes a while. And when I was there, it took about 2 hours.
And it's all volunteer run, or the volunteers are counting. How did they become involved?
Yeah, the volunteers don't necessarily have a research background or a science background before becoming counters, which I thought was really interesting. The volunteers I met were people who lived in the area and were passionate about butterflies for all kinds of reasons. And also, like one counter told me, just, you know, really believe in community science efforts like this one. So yeah, that's how they kind of became interested. And then what happens next is that you can get a training through the Xerces Society, which is, the full name is the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. And they have led a lot of these documentation efforts of monarchs and have been tracking them for a while and have this open training for anyone to learn how to do that.
So what is the training like to count butterflies?
It starts with this counting process, this really special method for counting butterflies. It's like an estimation. One of the counters I spoke to actually said it was kind of like counting jelly beans, but if the jelly beans are moving around. So it's like an estimation where you look at these big clusters of butterflies and then use this method of counting butterflies that, you know, obviously you can't count one by one. And it also helps you to do it quickly before they start flying around.
You mentioned that last year there weren't butterflies to count, which is just really scary given that, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions have been known to fly through our area. What is going on with the monarch butterfly population in California?
Mm-hmm. It's this big, you know, decades long issue that's been going on. But basically in the 80s, there used to be millions of monarchs that would migrate through California every year. But yeah, in recent years, that has really changed. Those numbers have really dwindled. And in 2020, last year, there were less than, or I guess a couple of years ago now, there were less than 2,000.
It all feels the same.
California. Yeah. But anyways.
You said less than 2,000, correct? I'm sorry,
less than
I interrupted
2,000.
You.
Yeah. No, exactly. But this year there was, you know, a really huge boom that kind of surprised everybody. And the official count that was tallied in November counted about 247,000. So in this year's migration, so that was, you know, a really big boost from what we've been seeing in recent years.
Oh yeah. From, you know, less than 2000 in 2020 to now more than, or nearly 250,000. I mean, that's great. But overall the number is declining. So why is that number declining in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically what I've been told is that there's not really a single reason that this is happening, but researchers have some guesses. And one guess that I heard over and over again was its connection to climate change. So, you know, like I mentioned earlier, monarchs are so sensitive to temperature and weather. And if temperatures rise earlier than usual, there's concern that it could mess with their migration cycle. I also talked to Liza Murphy, who's the director of education and outreach at the Pacific Grove Museum of Natural History, about this.
They've been adapted over thousands and thousands of years to a certain rhythm of nature. And now the pace of the change of nature is so much faster. They can't possibly adapt to spring arriving a month early or rain arriving 2 months late.
Yeah. And obviously there are going to be consequences to that as well for years. Mm-hmm. What should we make of this sudden boom in the population?
Yeah, so I also talked to Serena Jepson about this big boom, and she's the director of the Xerces Society, which I mentioned earlier, specifically the Endangered Species Program with them. And she told me that likely the boom was the result of just having, you know, the right conditions during breeding season last year, you know, maybe the right temperature, a good amount of milkweed, which is what monarch larvae eat. And it's not really certain if that is going to happen reliably again. So even though this year is a good thing, it doesn't mean that the future of monarchs is completely certain.
It's a very hopeful sign. And it, to me, it says we have a little bit more time to work on recovering the monarch population. They have not been wiped out as we had feared last year.
Yeah, and we're learning, you know, how sensitive monarch butterflies are to weather patterns. I mean, the individual before was saying, you know, if they can't adapt to spring, they arrive a month early, or rain arriving 2 months late. What happens if they leave too early? How can that affect the population?
Yeah, so some researchers worry that temperatures warming earlier in the year might be a signal for monarchs to also leave their overwintering spots early. So, you know, like leaving Pacific Grove too early. And anecdotally, the butterfly counters I met told me that they'd seen butterflies leaving earlier than usual you know, as early as mid-January, when usually they leave a month later than that. And the danger with that is that they could leave before their food source is ready, you know, milkweed, and that can have all these rippling effects. So, you know, if food isn't available when monarchs breed and they have babies, you know, that can really cut back on the number of monarchs we'll see in coming years, because, you know, what happens this year really directly translates to the monarchs we'll see next year. So it's important to keep milkweed safe, and also to keep track of, you know, if monarchs are leaving too early, where they're going, and making sure that the habitats that they end up in are, you know, healthy ones.
You were learning about volunteers in Pacific Grove, but monarch butterflies are throughout the state and in our area. What can we do to help preserve this population or the species?
That was, that was one of the, you know, really cool parts of this, is that, you know, again and again, I kept hearing that anyone can be part of this. So, you know, while we don't understand why this decline is happening, a lot of the work that's going on right now and tracking them can really help us understand and hopefully help them in the future. So yeah, basically, again, it helps researchers just understand monarchs better and, you know, following that, keep their habitat safer, and just, again, understand maybe a little bit more about why what's going on is going on. So again, this isn't something that you need to be a trained professional to do. Anyone can contribute. You know, you can go through that Xerces training, but even, you know, easier than that, you can document sightings of monarchs or milkweed and submit that online. The map online is called the Western Monarch Milkweed Mapper. And right, yeah, all of that contributes to our understanding of monarchs as a whole.
And that was my conversation with CAP Radio reporter Manola Sakaita on the monarch butterfly counters in Pacific Grove. Now is a great time to head to the coast and watch these monarchs in action. That is it for Insight today. Have a great weekend. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.